Good morning. So how many of you have heard of Marie Kondo and the KonMari method of decluttering? Excellent. She's been in the news recently because of her new TV show, but she had her book, her first English book that came out several years ago, was The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which is sort of it must be like a literal translation from Japanese. Her method is more of like a, not so much tidying up as a radical inventory of all your possessions, not really focusing on like cute storage solutions, but rather on truly paring down what you own to, this is her catchphrase, things that spark joy. So if you're holding on to things in your life for any other reason other than that they're useful and bring you joy, then you thank that item for the role it's played in your life and what it's taught you, and you let it go. So this has resulted in a lot of true believers and a lot of snarky internet memes and comics as well. I noticed this week that two of the comic strips in our papers had KonMari themes going. This is one. So in this series of comics, the mom has just binged the whole season of tidying up, and she wants to help her teenage son declutter his room, and he's not really feeling the spirit of KonMari-ing. I think we're good on that. Okay, so I am not a hoarder by nature, and I love this kind of thing, and I was all in after I read her book. So one thing that I ended up taking away that has really stayed with me, besides the whole spark joy kind of concept, which you have to hold loosely when you live with a lot of other people, was that this idea that the act of creating physical space and of letting go of physical possessions can create emotional and mental space in your life, that there's value in emptiness beyond just the aesthetic or the practical aspect. So this stuck out to me when I went through my books. I had used her method. She has this very strict order, the things like you're supposed to go through your possessions. First you're supposed to do your clothes, then household items, and then books are like down at the end of the line. And I found myself really resisting this because how can there be too many books in your life? But I did it. I took all the books in the entire house, except for the kids' books. So there were some of Tom's, but mostly mine. Put them on the floor in the family room. So hundreds and hundreds of books. And I realized how many books we had around that were not causing me or anyone else in the house joy. A lot of novels I'd read as an English major, and a few I meant to read but never had. And when I looked at them, I just had this really complicated kind of grief and guilt that I was no longer the 20-year-old who could just sit down and consume a 19th century novel in a few sittings, which is silly because I don't want to be 20 years old again, but I did kind of miss that piece of myself. So I thank these books and Thomas Hardy and Charles Dickens for what they had taught me, and then I let them move on to Goodwill. And when I put the remaining books back, I made sure that the shelf in my room had some empty space. And do you know, after that, I read more fiction than in the previous, I don't know, maybe decade combined. I found new authors that I loved and some old ones as well. So somehow that physical act of creating space created the mental and the emotional space that I needed to move on and find new books to love. So I thought of that this week when I was preparing this sermon and thinking about the season of Lent, which traditionally has been a time of letting go, of offering up our lives to God, and of creating space for God to act and to dwell. Now, usually when we think of giving to God, we think of giving out of our abundance. So not necessarily like our extra, but we think of what we have, and then about that portion that we could reasonably, or unreasonably, depending on how generous we are, give to God. So the Old Testament passage from today describes the idea of giving God our first fruits. The very best and first of what God's blessings are should be offered back to God. And that doesn't just apply in the Bible to those with great riches. You think of the story of the widow's mite and her being commended by Jesus for offering what she had. That's also evident there. And this is a really worthwhile and biblical paradigm, one that has blessed and continued to bless many people and communities. But I think it's not the only way to think about giving. And I'd like to suggest that during this season of Lent, we think in different terms. So instead of offering to God what we have, what if we offer to God what we don't have and ask God to use that lack for God's purpose? What if we offer God our emptiness? So what does that mean exactly? I'm thinking of two types of emptiness that God desires us to surrender: those we have chosen and those we haven't. So the first type, the emptiness we choose, fits in more closely with the traditional idea of giving up something for Lent, maybe something that's distracting us from being present with God or creating unhealthy behaviors. A vice like gossip or envy, a habit like computer use, sugar, and those, that giving up can be very meaningful. I'm also thinking, though, of something wider than that, creating some empty space or time, and then just kind of standing back and sitting with that emptiness and seeing what God allows to happen in that space. Now, I'm not really talking about self-care, which is a worthy goal, but something kind of different. Some empty space or time without a specific agenda. Now, I'm a pretty task-oriented person with 5 children who thought it would be a great idea to volunteer to lead Sunday school, preach the sermon, and cook lunch for 15 people today. So I'm not here to make you feel guilty if you're not spending an hour in prayer and meditation each day. And if you are prioritizing that kind of open space, then I commend that too. And think that does bless the entire church. But I think we can be creative in how we think about this idea of open time. At the Ash Wednesday service, Beth Miller shared the story of how she was in a rush one time at the store and avoided speaking to an acquaintance while grocery shopping, not because she didn't like her, didn't want to talk to her, just because, you know, she was eyes on the prize, focused on getting through her tasks for the day. And how that friend soon after was killed in a car accident. And so she now approaches grocery shopping mindfully with the idea that the people that she runs into, she will take the time to talk to. I was really convicted by that, and I also really just love the idea of mindfully entering a routine activity with the goal of offering up as a time of being open to and connecting with friends and strangers. I also liked what Don Kaufman said today when he was talking about MDS. Now, I know those MDS guys, and they like to get stuff done. Like, it's that very, strong work ethic, like to just see things happen. But he said when you're building a house for somebody or working on someone's house and the owner or the person who lives there want to talk to you, that is what you do. You sit down and you talk with them. You don't go on with your work. I like that. Or let's think in terms of physical space. Maybe clear out a meditation or prayer space, but don't fill it right away. Put an extra board in your table and place more chairs around the table. I can't actually do this because our table's super crowded already. We could leave space in your car for an extra passenger. Go through your books and leave space on your bookshelf. The thing is not to fill that space right away. This is such a huge temptation. Nature does not love a vacuum, as we all know. If you create any kind of emptiness, I can guarantee that you will immediately think of ways to fill it. And the things of the world will come gushing in to fill it like a waterfall. And they may be good things, but they aren't necessarily the things that God desires. So when we experience this temptation to fill our own emptiness, we're really following in Jesus' footsteps. This was Jesus' temptation. He went out to the wilderness, so he deliberately went to a place empty of the demands and distractions of the villages and cities. And at the end of the time, he was physically empty. He was hungry and thirsty and presumably lonely. And who came in to fill that need? Well, it was the devil. The things the devil were offering were not necessarily bad things. I mean, one of them was bread, which is like the most wholesome food ever, and later the foundation of the most ancient and holy of Christian rituals, it's just that Jesus was not supposed to fill his emptiness from that source. And that time in the wilderness seems to have been key to everything that came after in his ministry. So in light of that, I thought it was interesting how in the passage from the Old Testament that we read earlier, how they phrased the story of the children of Israel. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs of wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Are we missing something here? Like 80 years wandering in the wilderness? That way of telling the story skips that part. Because before the children of Israel could enter the promised land, they were sojourners, consistently fractious, disobedient sojourners in the emptiness of the wilderness. And those years were really crucial to their understanding of themselves and God. So that's the first kind of emptiness. The second kind of emptiness is the kind we have not chosen. And that's also a really scary thing to offer up to God. Relationships that have become broken and empty. Spiritual emptiness that has left us searching for answers. Physical emptiness. Right now we have a nursery that's empty. An empty spot at your table because a loved one has died or is estranged. An empty couch today. I believe that God desires us to offer that emptiness too, to wholeheartedly surrender it and rest in the knowledge that God can transform it. So the story that came to mind when I was thinking about this was the one of Elisha and the woman who comes to him, and she's a widow. She owes a lot of money. Her two children are going to be taken to use as slaves to help pay her debt. And she only has this small jar of olive oil. And so this is what Elisha tells her. Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side. And of course she does that, and the oil keeps coming out and filling all the containers, and she eventually has enough to pay her debts. So my favorite line in this story is, don't ask for just a few. God's provision is abundant, but God somehow needs our abundant emptiness. That passage continues with story after story of emptiness that was transformed by God. A woman who wanted a child, people who needed food. In fact, if we look at the amazing acts of God throughout the Bible, they often have a common factor, which is emptiness. The earth was without form and empty. Sarah was barren. Hannah was barren. Elizabeth was barren. The crowd was hungry. And the ultimate, Jesus emptying himself. It says of Jesus in, I think, Philippians, who though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. Now, despite my affinity for the life-changing magic book, I don't want to give the impression that I think there is actually some element of magic in this, that we can somehow compel God to fill us with good things by doing X, Y, and Z. That's a dangerous mental trap to fall into. We offer God our emptiness and then trust. And God's way of dealing with our emptiness may not look how we'd like it to. Jesus went out into the wilderness and was faithful and resisted temptation. And the next story is Jesus rejected at Nazareth. People literally try to throw him off a cliff. So, the fullness of God's love and care may not be visible for a long time, maybe not even in our lifetimes. We're talking about the creator of the universe in an entirely different scale of time and space. But every story of God's great work begins with emptiness. I believe we can be part of that story, and that we are part of that story. So our Lenten table here that Belinda put together represents the wilderness, the stones that we venture into it, that we venture into at Lent. We are not alone, as the opening words remind us. We have the scriptures and the cross and the promise of light. Throughout Lent, during the offering time, I'd like for us to have a chance to symbolically offer our emptiness to God by placing empty bowls on the table. So I invite you to think about a specific area of emptiness in your life that you want to surrender to God. And we're going to be doing this throughout Lent, so there's no pressure to think of everything today. Or an intention to create space to observe and partner in God's work. So kind of the idea of the emptiness we choose and the emptiness that is there for us. And so during the offering time, you can get a bowl if you want and place it somewhere on the table. And then if you feel comfortable doing so, there's something you'd like the congregation's support in, feel free to share during the sharing time what the bowl represents for you. But there's no obligation to do that. I'm going to do that now by offering up this bowl that represents the couch here, the emptiness where we like Glenda to be. Please join me in prayer. God, we thank you that you are near in our abundance and our emptiness. Please give us the courage to offer up our emptiness to you.